Folks, you're listening to Revolution Radio here at freedomslips.com, and coming at you next, this is Carrie Cassidy with Whistleblower Radio, Project Canalot. So without much further ado, here's Carrie Cassidy. Take it away, Carrie.
Stretched out and purring, waiting for more.
Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. I don't know if you can hear this. Just having a little bit of fun here. To focus the mind.
I just want a good show. That's all they want. You know how to hunt. Show them how good you are.
Okay, so at any rate, that was a bit of an excerpt from Hunger Games, which I highly recommend the book, I want to say, because it's a very astute metaphor for what we are living through right now, like it or not. And so I just wanted to give you a heads up about that. I've got David Cereda on the line here with me, and we're going to have a lot of fun. David, are you there?
Yes, I am, Carrie.
Awesome. And David is, well, you've got a background dealing with NASA on various levels, and I believe that you have quite an interesting science background, but you also made a departure and got into sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, metaphysics or whatever, at a certain point. I know you were, when I originally came across you, you were showing the STS footage, and that was very impressive at the time to me. And I do want to catch up with you and see where you're at now and sort of get your trajectory, a little bit of your trajectory before we go into, you know, to get down to it. So if you wouldn't mind, we're Revolution Radio, by the way. I just want to say hi to everybody. It's a lot of fun for me to start a show on Friday nights here. I normally do a Wednesday show on American Freedom Radio. I'm still doing that, but we have expanded, and I'm just showing up here on Revolution Radio. And so it's a moving target, as you can appreciate. And so, David, like I was saying, if you want to give yourself your own background, and then we'll go from there.
Well, you know, I'm 50 years old, and I'm a father now. I have a 1.5-year-old daughter, so it's a pretty amazing journey for me, because my background in life, I come from a family of lawyers and judges, and my father is a psychologist from Berkeley. We're Canadians, and we moved to Berkeley in the mid-60s, 64-ish. And, you know, on my way home from elementary school one day when I was 8 years old, I saw a clear flying saucer, the only true metallic saucer in daylight I'd ever seen in my whole life, actually. And I, with a friend of mine, watched it, and pandemonium on the street that day. People were going crazy over it. The Lawrence Berkeley National Lab up on the hill would have had a perfect view of it. And after 20 minutes, it just blinked out. And in the following days, I had contacts with them, and they were human. They paralyzed my body. They, were teaching me about the propulsion system of their craft, who they were, their Palladian. A lot of things for a 7-year-old, you know, boy to go through. And when an experience like that happens to you right off the mark at a very young age, it's really hard to fit into any paradigm structure, you know, and any standard model of education. And so I, you know, my dad was studying with different gurus from India, different meditators, and doing yoga and vegetarian food. And he was living up in Vancouver, and my mom had divorced him, actually, in the 60s, because everything was too wild at Berkeley for her. And my four brothers and I grew up with a science teacher under the name Cooper. I was actually David Cooper for almost a decade. And then all of a sudden, you know, from that kind of very normal all-American life baseball, I was moved to my real father's house with my brothers up in Canada, back to Canada, and it just turned everything upside down. I mean, we got introduced to yoga, meditation, and we really resisted it. We were non-believers. So we had nothing invested in it. We hated the whole concept of yoga and vegetarian food, and we laughed at it. And one day my dad took me to a yoga retreat with a teacher named Baba Haridas, who's still alive. He lives in Santa Cruz Mountains. And in the middle of the night, my body became paralyzed, very similar to the ET contact experiences. And I was very comfortable with it. I just saw my legs getting paralyzed. I was sleeping in the tent. Then my neck and then my arms fell down, and boom, there were these three shining blue beings. One was a monkey man, and this woman and a man who were astoundingly beautiful with all these jewels in their third eye and shining in this blue light. I was seeing them in this vision perfectly clearly. I had never heard of who these people were. I had never read a book. I was just introduced to this in a crash course. And the next morning I told the yoga instructor to tell the master what had happened. And he took me over to a painting of Hanuman, the Hindu god Hanuman, and Rama and Sita. And I said, oh, that's them. That's who I saw last night. And when these things happen, you just, once again, you're going, through your elementary school and into high school, and you realize, this, nobody can answer this stuff. Nobody can answer. I took physics classes and excelled greatly in them, and when I remember introducing a theory on time and space to my physics professor, and he said, this is one of Einstein's most advanced theories. He said, where did you get this? And I said, I've never even read Einstein. I'd only heard his name, but I'd never really studied his physics theories. And he said, but this is exactly his theory about time and space. And it was very elaborate. I did whole models for him and everything. So I eventually didn't fit in to the standard model, kept doing yoga, kept meditating, had my first, wonderful love of my life when I was between 18 and 21 years old. And I had started meditating every single day by the time I was 18, doing rigorous practices and meditation retreats and accelerating in consciousness. And so that's kind of where it began, for me.
I hear you. So how did you get involved with NASA?
Well, I had, over the years, I had 22 years of my life, I was planting trees in the mountains of British Columbia. And the other half of the year, I was working with science and projects in Los Angeles and writing film scripts that never got made. And I ended up getting a job working with this company called the Advanced Physics Corporation in Irvine, California, where I was around all these Nobel Prize winners and working on a non-radioactive helium-3 nuclear energy project with Bogdan Castle-Magwitch, Glenn Seaborg, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, Norman Rostocker, all these, Murray Gell-Mann, all these amazing physicists around all the time. And I had to learn it on my own to work there and to represent them. And we were trying to get this non-radioactive nuclear power source funded by every means we could, and that was part of my job. I made introductions at the Southern California Edison Company, and they almost invested but decided not to. And I developed relations at NASA, and really good ones. And in fact, Earl Van Landingham, who at the time in the late 80s was the head of the whole space rocket propulsion power division at NASA, he really wanted us to get funded because our helium-3 reactor had the ability to send spacecraft all the way up to a tenth the speed of light, which we can't even imagine that today. And Earl is a rocket scientist. He later becomes head of all space access and technology at NASA. So I'm opening all these doors. I have, access in the military, access at NASA. And a friend of mine in Canada, Michael Boyle, had introduced me to a man named Martin Stubbs, a name now that a lot of people have heard of. And Martin came to me and had all this footage from space shuttle missions of anomalous UFO phenomena on tape that nobody had. I mean, Martin had the biggest collection in the world. He was sitting there at Shaw Cable in North Vancouver, popping in, you know, tapes and recording all the, you know, missing minutes, every minute of every mission, and scouring it and finding these gems. These gems were, you would see things that looked like craft. For example, the tether incident was discovered by Martin and many, many others. And he came to me and he said, you know, can you get some answers? Can you get a dialogue going at NASA about them? And I did. And I did that for years clandestinely until, and I, it's amazing what I was getting. You know, I'm talking to their top physicists. I know the language. I know the science. I know exactly what, you know, the process of elimination is, how to eliminate a dust ball, how to eliminate optical effects, you know, through the lens, airy discs, all of it. And I'm getting NASA scientists to admit that there's something phenomenal going on the tapes. And when I was doing that, Martin had shared some of my letters with Russell Callahan and Graham Birdsall in the UK. They stole my letters, they went public, and they stole everything, basically, and turned it into a huge public display, and I was just booted out of it at that point, because as soon as NASA found out that their letters to me were all over the media, they wouldn't talk to me anymore. It was over, and I was so upset.
Wow.
I was so upset, Carrie, because I was so close. I mean, a scientist named at the University of Iowa, Lewis A. Frank, a Van Allen Carver professor of physics and massive award-winning scientist, principal investigator on many of our satellite missions to the various planets, he was already dealing with a phenomena that no one at NASA could explain. He was almost outcasted himself, because he was seeing these giant disks showing up in the ultraviolet, in the invisible, on still cameras set up on satellites all over the solar system. And his theory was these things were giant balls of water that were depositing into our atmosphere, but you couldn't see them in the visible light spectrum. And when I sent him the NASA tapes of the tether incident, he said, I can tell you that these are not. And I repeat this clearly, because everyone has said, including people in the UFO movement, that these are just airy discs, out-of-focus airy discs. He knows how to take the footage into a spectrograph and determine the light curves and reflectivity on the pinpoint light sources and the discs that you see in the tether incident, and determine whether they are pieces of dust reflecting light. And he said they're not. He said these are the same things that I've been dealing with. He said, but I've never seen them in motion before. He was so excited. He was getting more and more footage from me. And then he was about to make a statement. And then he heard the news that Graham Birdsall and Russell Callahan, he said, well, who are these guys? And my name is everywhere in England. And I said, I didn't do it. And that was it. He wouldn't speak to me anymore.
Wow, that's incredible. But what was the significance? First of all, you know, I've seen that footage. You know, I've seen your talks, even in the early days, actually before Camelot, I saw the footage. And there seems no doubt in my mind that these are at least UFOs at the level of coming into this dimension. Maybe you might call them plasma vehicles. Maybe you'd call them, you know, just normal UFOs, just coming, you know, into the dimension. But with Birdsall and this other Callahan, as you call them, how did they, like, what was their mission? Who were they? I've heard the names, but I don't, I'm not placing them.
You know, the Martin Stubb footage and the smoking gun footage, they sold his tapes. And they made, you know, a lot of money on it, you know, more money than I've ever made on any film today, because this is pre-internet times when you actually had to pay for a DVD. And then they sold it to William Burns and his partner, Jess Zagansky. It was all sold after, because one of them, there's Graham Birdsall and Russell Callahan with UFO Magazine in the UK, and they became millionaires on the NASA footage, which I had made famous going on my first show with Art Bell, and, you know, in the year 2000 or 1999.
So, But how did they implicate you in a, you know what I'm saying, such that NASA wouldn't speak to you anymore? Well, what was their tactic?
Well, I wasn't ready to go public yet. I had a lot of good connections from working in the nuclear fusion world at NASA, and I was getting answers. I wasn't a known figure. Nobody knew my name. I wasn't on the map. I was waiting until I was done to go public. But they took my letters and got them, you know, through Martin, through emails, and they went public before I even had a chance to finish my investigation.
Right, but did they steal? In other words, did they hack your email? I mean, what was the situation?
No, Martin was sending them copies of my emails. I didn't know, but he didn't think they were going to go public with it. They just did it. They did it without his permission, too.
Okay, and who was Martin?
Martin Stubbs is the program manager of a cable TV station in Canada who recorded the Tether incident and all the other incidents.
Oh, right. He's the one you were saying earlier. So he sent it to them without your okay, or just both of you
He sent it. They belonged to him. I was just doing an investigation. I told Martin, don't let these guys go public until I'm done. Because you don't understand, once a name is mentioned at NASA, it's over. And it was after that I was on Art Bell and arguing with James Oberg, my first big radio show ever, about the footage and about the fact that the cameras could see certifiably into the near and far ultraviolet light spectrum where the human eye doesn't see. And on that point, when I was arguing with James Oberg, Art Bell's radio station was shut down worldwide. The satellite, the internet broadcast, the ground-based broadcast, they turned off worldwide. And James Oberg and I were arguing, and I heard Art Bell's tone go way down. And it was the next day he said the whole show, the majority of the show, was gone. It was clipped off the air, and he got a letter from NSA the next day saying David Sirita was naming names and persons at NASA, but the public is not ready for it this time, and they turned it off.
That
landed me in the biggest conspiracy in Art Bell's radio show.
You know, I might have been listening because I used to listen all the time, and I think I heard about that. I think I was actually might have been on the air at the time. I mean, just listening. But when was the date of that? Do you remember?
It's about the year 2000. It's 2000 or 2001. I'm pretty sure it was 2000. It might have been 1999. I've been public ever since that day.
Right.
Art Bell talked about it for the next three nights and the Area 51 caller as the only two times the show was turned off. But then there have been a number of times I've been on with George Norrie where several states, they just turn the show off. The satellite goes off and my other phone is ringing and it's off everywhere.
So once that happened, and then you got the cold shoulder, so to speak, from NASA, how did you, because you kind of kept on from there, how did you survive?
Well, what happened with fusion is, you know, we literally got to the richest people in the world. We got the Resniks with the Franklin Mint, you know, all the big world players, even Michael Jackson's partner, Brett Strong. Everybody turned us down. You know, Linda Ronstadt, Jane Fonda. Nobody wanted to fund non-radioactive helium-3 energy. And it was really shocking to me.
Why didn't they? Why didn't they?
Everybody's into being anti-nuclear. Like, look what's happening with Fukushima
right
now. We're actually sitting now with reactor 4 and 2 with possibly another incident that will dwarf the first incident. And we can't even imagine. There are reports from top medical journals that 13,000 American children died as a result of the radiation from Fukushima. We lost almost as many people as they did, and their children. And
so this
cares,
is helium. This is helium, and this is, but a, you're calling
helium,
it a non-radioactive.
Helium-3 produces the energy of equivalent of 9 grams of it produces the energy equivalent of 1,000 barrels of oil. There's no radiation in helium-3. It's mostly abundant in moon dust. Clinton Ashworth,
really?
Who was supervising mechanical engineer for Pacific Gas and Electric in the Bay Area, told me that one cargo bay in the space shuttle full of moon dust has enough helium-3 to meet the energy demands of the entire United States for a whole year. That's how loaded moon dust is with energy, and that's why aliens are mining the dark side of the moon, because it's
right.
The most, and it's, there's no radiation in helium-3. We had spent $26 million on 4 tests over the years. The last computer feasibility study was done at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico by Major D. Lambert. And the simulation said that a cubic meter reactor, according to our designs, was going to work. And based on that model, Earl Van Landingham at NASA said, wait a minute, helium-3 is so powerful, not only as a power source, a full billion watts of power in a cubic meter with no radiation, it makes the ultimate power source for space stations and space rockets, because the ion propulsion drives with the power, these 18 million electron volt charged protons coming out of the back of our reactor, could fire a spacecraft in the opposite direction at a tenth the speed of light, which is about 67 million miles an hour. There's nobody can go that fast. And
well,
Earl,
so why,
I
don't understand. Why was this left? In other words, it sort of sounds like you had to abandon this line of research, right?
Well, I was working with all these physicists, and in the off season, I went tree planting in Canada, planted another 50,000 trees, and came home in L.A. and on my own dime was trying to get people in Hollywood and all of my connections, and they eventually hired me to do fundraising. And on the phone, Royal Dutch Shell threatened my life and said, "If you keep pursuing this," and Shell had invested over $1.5 million in our test models. And once they knew it was going to work, they wanted to can it. They didn't want, because we could make tiny helium-3 reactors, put them under the hood of an electric car, and you could drive for a year before you need to refuel.
Okay, but
a year.
But at this point, don't you think that they probably took this technology and are using it?
No, they're doing other things. They have other technology. You know, my connections go very deep, even today, into a lot of places. And I know their biggest problem, even with their government UFOs, is they're still very radioactive. They're using radioactive nuclear fields. They're not.
But why would they be doing that? That doesn't make sense.
There's a lot of things that don't make sense when you're talking to people, you know, in those worlds. It's all about competition. It's more, when you talk to scientists, like my friend Boyd Bushman at Lockheed Martin, who was with Howard Hughes, he was at Hughes Aircraft, he spent 22 years at Lockheed, he worked for Texas Instruments, he worked for General Dynamics, he invented the Stinger missile with a whole team of researchers, and he told me, he said, the real problem is there's a buddy system, and a general likes to give the contracts to people that he knows who give him kickbacks. And so they don't really care who necessarily has the best technology. America's not like it used to be. In the 60s and the 50s, it used to be about the best technology, staying on top of the world, and always having the upper hand. It's now a competition of feeding families and friends who kick back big money to, you give, generals give the contracts out to Boeing and Lockheed, and then they get kickbacks. And so it's all about who's got what.
Okay, but
it's not
so
about the best thing for the country anymore.
Well, I have to say that this must be on a certain level of the space program, but on another level, they have gone way beyond this.
Yeah, on another level, they have, but yet they're not as advanced as you might want to think. I mean, we can fly. We have levitating craft. We have alien visitors that they know about. They're doing things that a slight diversion, but it's going to bring us right back. I mean, one of the big things we're talking about tonight is the huge energy waves that are coming into the solar system that are transforming human DNA.
Yes.
And they know what's happening. I have detectors set up all over my place, and I can see these waves when they come in. And this is really shocking. This is my theory on chemtrails. I mean, we're being bombarded in Sedona for the last week with massive chemtrails, especially tonight. Chemtrails are dumping out a lot of aluminum, and aluminum is a paramagnetic metal. Paramagnetic means that when you turn on an electromagnetic transmitter or microwave beam into it, it immediately becomes magnetic only when you have the transmitter turned on, which means it's a massive antenna array. So by spraying all that aluminum dust in the atmosphere, you've got a huge antenna to beam mind control frequencies into to stop the evolution that the cosmos is trying to activate in our DNA. And they can actually do this. They can.
Okay. Yes. And but let me just say that the other night I was talking to Jim Stone, who's this NSA whistleblower, and he was describing this a similar thing and saying that it's a conductor, but that it actually what it also does is send. I guess they can send a pulse through this sort of aluminum conducting material that then goes into the earth and heats it. Have you heard this?
No, I haven't. No. I had put out the paramagnetic. See, paramagnetism, yeah, aluminum is a conductor, but it's copper and aluminum are paramagnetic, and they're which basically makes them a super powerful antenna beam. Now, I have done something very unusual. I have invented a small transmitting device using rubies and a crystal oscillator core electromagnet that I invented, and I've decoded 180 frequencies of the Great Pyramid as a crystal oscillator, what are known as the infinities. This is all in my new differential mathematics work, and I'm able to pulse with a very weak power source, actually, only 35-watt amplifier, and get a huge energy field out of this and still remain legal and not broadcasting into the microwave spectrum and interfering with radio transmissions, and broadcast harmonic frequencies into my local field environment of my house. And we're having amazing mystical and spiritual experiences just using the small transmitter. And people can see, if you go to my channel on YouTube, Spaceman99, you'll see this thing in action.
Cool.
Four ball that's on plates that goes zipping around on the plates only with the pyramid frequencies. Now, single frequencies, like healing frequencies, like 432 or, you know, Len Horowitz's number, don't move the magnets around. They just vibrate. If I send out the NASA sound of the sun through the transmitter.
Okay, we're actually going to go to a short break here at the bottom of the hour, and then we're going to resume with David Cereda. Thank you so much, David.
Listening to Revolution Radio. We'll be right back after this short break, so stay tuned.
For our show Everything Psychic at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we will be taking listener callers and doing live psychic readings on the air at Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Please visit my website at www.thereadersgroup.com for more info, and we look forward to seeing you then.
Every Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time for
Pulling Back the Curtain.
With your co-host Joseph Atwell, Fritz Heed, and Neola Sparkus. Seeing world events, the global paradigm shift of 2012, financial markets, geopolitics, and religion versus spirituality. All through the lens of Joseph Atwell's groundbreaking historical discovery, Caesar's Messiah. Here on Revolution Radio, at Sunday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Pulling back the curtain on the world today.
Thanks for listening. While we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
We at Project Camelot.
Hi, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. I guess we're back on the air. David, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. I wasn't sure there for a moment. I just want to say that there are two chat rooms, I guess, going on. One is if you go to projectcamelot.org, our main portal page, and you can go down to the radio icon and click on the chat icon there or link. There is a chat room ongoing on that link as normal with my radio shows. And then I understand that Revolution Radio also has a chat room, and that would be at freedomslips.com, I imagine. So either way, you could basically join us on the chat rooms. I do have somebody standing by to grab questions out of the chat rooms. So if you can go ahead and join those chat rooms, and we're going to see if we can grab the questions and run those by David later in the show. That way you can participate. So we're also fooling around with getting an intro together for me for this show. We've had a few sort of glitches along the way, but sooner or later we're going to have something together for you. So to get back on the subject here, David, what you're saying is that you're taking, I guess, I'm not even sure, you're taking the energetics and you're switching them around somehow. What are you using to do that? Is it the ruby? I mean, what would you say is changing the dynamic?
Well, no, it's we're kind of a frequency-obsessed society, and as far as, you know, alternative healing, you know, even the right frequencies, we're talking about specific frequencies, which is the number of times a wave oscillates per second. But my work in differentials has been, imagine a violin and a cello playing. First you hear the violin alone, and then you hear the cello alone, and then when you mix them, there's a sound in between them that neither of them possess on their own. When two frequencies or more, and sometimes many more, rub against each other, there's a very, very fine gap between their vibrations, and that's called a differential or difference. And that is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in those tiny spaces where vibrations are rubbing against each other. They're like micro vacuum cleaners that pull energy from invisible dimensions into ours and back out again. And my argument has been that geometry and sacred geometry has a deep flaw in that many of our geometries, in fact, most of them, are all even-sided. And in nature, you only see uneven geometries. And I do all the math on those uneven geometries and determine the numbers of all of the waveforms working together to produce the differentials. And those little guys are the harmonic spaces between the violin and the cello and the bass and, you know, the whole symphony. And they're actually more powerful than single standalone frequencies. So when I looked at the Great Pyramid as a giant crystal oscillator complex, and I read Peter Lemazurier's book, The Great Pyramid Decoded, in the 1970s. It was one of the first books I ever read, you know, in the world of mystical arts. And I reread it, you know, today with my electronics building background. I went, oh my God, I know what this is, and no one's figured it out. And I was able to use his math and his base measurements to determine the frequencies of this giant crystal oscillator. What a crystal oscillator is, you know, remember your watch and it said quartz on your watch, and it was very exciting to have quartz timing because it was so accurate and your watch didn't go out of whack for, you know, at least a year. That's because there's a little tiny piece of quartz crystal in there in between two thin middle plates. And when you electrically charge a crystal, the electrons, which are the carriers of electric force, jump out of the atom's nucleus and oscillate around the crystal, producing frequencies, hence crystal oscillator. Crystal oscillators are also used in tuning devices and timing devices and tuning radios to different frequencies. So with that idea, I started to do the math and dividing all of these amazing dimensions of the pyramid into the speed of electromagnetism or light to get my frequencies, and I went, oh my God, look at these numbers. And then I got a signal generator program, and I was able to produce all of the different frequencies and blend them and then slow them down into the human ear's audible range between 20 and 20,000 hertz and listen to them. I went, these are stunningly beautiful. This is not an accident. These numbers really mean something. And I had, you know, I have had a lot of experience with working with magnets and magnetic field transmitters, and I decided to invent something very different in that I was going to make it a crystal oscillator electromagnet, but I wasn't going to use a tiny piece of crystal like they use in quartz watches. I was going to use a lot of it. And I created this, I took a flashlight tubing, which is what you see in the Spaceman 99 video on YouTube of my pyramid frequencies, and I was able to transmit these pyramid frequencies through it. And inside of it are rubies. You know, they're very expensive rubies. And people can get these things from me if they want one. And when you transmit the pyramid frequencies, I started to feel with the magnet in its presence, the magnet wanted to move around. And I wasn't used to this. I was used to a transmitter only causing the magnet to vibrate at a distance from the transmitter, not move around. So I put four magnets on plates, and they all started zipping around. And there's only 35 watts maximum going through that transmitter. And I put the meters, you can see all these meters next to it, and I'm getting a huge field. I'm getting like, you know, 500 to 1,000 plus, even 2,000 milligauss spikes at a distance. And I went, oh my God, is this how the sun is causing the planets to move around? Does the pyramid know the secret to gravity and anti-gravity? Are these numbers, these sacred numbers that I'm moving through this device, are they the real secret to anti-gravity? And they really are, on a deeper level. And I know what this technology could lead to. But my first interest in the technology was to see how the human bioelectric field would respond to it. Now, if you go on Google and you Google the Egyptian Dendera light bulb, have you ever seen that?
Yes, yes.
Everybody, you see this very tall, what I believe is an 8-foot-tall Egyptian god, and little humans underneath it, and this 8-foot-tall tube with a coil inside of it. And you can see a cord coming out of it. And everybody thought it must be a light bulb. But if you ever sat in front of a 500-watt big light bulb, and you go blind, it's too bright, and you wonder, what are these people doing sitting so close to a supposed light bulb? And I went, this isn't a light bulb. This is a transmitting wand is what this is. And these gods are using it to transmit information to human DNA to initiate these human subjects to activate their DNA to take it to a higher level. And I realized that I could transmit not only the pyramid codes, but the phi and the golden number codes, which I also do. And I could take the NAF, the sound of the sun. I could take any harmonic, including my infinity numbers, which were discovered originally by the Greek genius mathematician pre-Pythagorean Archimedes. And infinity numbers are like 1 to 111111 or 1 to 99999, right? So, and I went, oh my God, and I could transmit these through the wand, and I could activate DNA with it and cause a huge shift in consciousness, because we know from all of the consciousness studies that magnetic fields carrying harmonic information can activate DNA. And then I realized that the Egyptians were not using the wand probably not only for human subjects, but to actually turn on the crystal oscillation process in the Great Pyramid. And why would they want to do that, to turn the pyramids on? And I had researched on Google some years ago when I was developing this theory that, has anybody seen the Great Pyramid get struck by lightning? And if they did, what did they see? And some guy wrote, he saw the pyramid get struck by lightning at nighttime, and it glowed with a blue hue for several minutes afterwards. And I went, yes, I know what the blue hue is. That's the, when you ionize the crystal content of the limestone and the granite core, you're going to get, the electrons are going to oscillate in the crystal oscillator and set up an energy field. And if, and what would be the purpose of doing that? And I realized very, very deeply in my work on faster than light communication signaling that there were experiments done, two of them, one at the University of California at Berkeley, the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab by Raymond Chow in the 1990s. And I spoke to Dr. Chow. He didn't really understand why it was happening. But he was in Discover magazine. Everybody was talking about him. He got light to go faster than the speed of light. And he did it using quartz crystals. He had a crystal light source, beam light source, send two photons or particles of light. One of them went through a thin, thin slice of silica, which is quartz. And that one went 1.7 times the speed of light, and the other one went light speed. And you go, you know, what is it about silica? Let's find out about quartz. You know, what is it about it that caused the light to accelerate faster than the speed of light? Well, if you look at everything on the periodic table, from a piece of wood to a piece of metal to quartz crystal to gems and rubies, everything has a chemical formula that is made up of little geometries, little tiny little molecules, atoms bonding together in angles and corners to produce what's known as the crystal lattice, the structure of the molecule form. And the molecule forming or lattice of silica is a tetrahedron or three-sided pyramid. And what happens in a three-sided pyramid is when a waveform strikes it, the waves oscillate up into the apex of the pyramid, and the frequency oscillations get so high at the apex, they go faster than light speed. They quantum tunnel, actually, and then they go light faster than light speed.
Well, okay, now I just want to stop you right there for a second because, I don't know if you're familiar with our interview with Ralph Ring.
No, I know Ralph, actually. He lives near me.
But have you ever seen that interview?
No.
Okay, when he got into the craft... I don't know. Do you know his story?
Yeah. I know about Otis Carr and Tesla.
Right.
And craft, yeah.
Okay, but one of the things that Otis Carr told them to do was meditate on aquamarine, the color aquamarine.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what allowed them to actually activate the crystal in the craft and time travel.
Mm-hmm.
It was using their minds in connection with the crystal. And the color aquamarine. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because there is some kind of a correlation with actually the color aquamarine and what you're talking about, faster than the speed of light travel. Because you can appreciate that if you're time traveling, you want to go faster than the speed of light in order to time travel.
Sure.
Well, so there is a time travel element to this that you're talking about also.
Well, exactly. I mean, the crystals, I don't know if you've been to any of the conferences where I've been lately, but we have these harmonically treated crystal pendants people are getting from us, and we measure the body electricity through the fingertips and with a voltmeter, the millivolts and the microamps, and when people connect with our pendants, their energy levels go up. You can see it on the meters. And you can see on aura cameras, their aura gets brighter, so hence they're more telepathic. They're more powerful. And in the same way, your computer, which has got an Intel chip in it with over a billion transistors now, which are little pieces of crystal and conductor material, gold or silver, different types of conductor material. And transistors were invented in 1947 by Will Shockley, John Bardeen, and Will Bratton, and they are crystal technology. And they're they're kind of an advancement beyond the crystal oscillator concept, because transistors are used to amplify signals. So crystals are responsible for everything we have in technology today. Your super fancy iPods and iPads and computers, none of it works without the crystal transistors. So to what Ralph Ring is talking about is absolutely is true, it rings true, that crystals are part of the alien technology. But what I found, what was more exciting, I mean, think of the Pleiades, for example. The Pleiades have been lining up conjunct with Venus in this past week, which is really exciting. They're 440 light years away, which means on your cell phone it would take 440 years to get a message to them. Well, at Princeton University, a Chinese-American physicist, Li Jun Wang, he sent a beam of light, actually several beams of light, into cesium sulfide gas, and it went 300 times the speed of light through the cesium. The cesium generated a signal that caused the light beam to accelerate 300 times the speed of light, which is time travel. And I said, what is the crystal lattice structure of cesium? And guess what it is? It's six square-based, four-sided pyramids faced into each other. It's like a cube with pyramids, four-sided pyramids, all pointing into each other. Once again, you have pyramidal geometries with in a form of crystal.
Is that an octahedron?
No. It's octa is eight. It's called cubic faced in the lattice geometry network, but it's actually more complicated than that. But the point is, once again, you have, because not everything in the lattice structure on the periodic table is pyramids. You have cubes, you have triangles, you have all sorts of different geometries. And they cataloged all these geometries in the 18 and 1900s. And I actually don't believe they did a perfect job of it. I mean, that's a whole other argument. But nevertheless, pyramids are responsible for this. So now you go to Linda Moulton Howe on her website. She has this Yucatan pyramid where a guy with his iPhone was taking a picture of the Chichen Itza pyramid, and I've been there, and a lightning strike is in the background, very exciting, and a column of light is jettisoning out of the top of the pyramid, going out into the sky. And I went, oh my God, I know what that is. Of course, the lightning strike ionized the pyramid because it's made of, you know, you go down there and you got a lot of, it looks like almost like coral calcium in the stone. And calcium is an electrolyte. It's a very powerful electrolyte. So, meaning it can carry an electric charge. And very, very good material, pyramids. And you see this cone of light, and somebody thought, oh, that's just one of those bands, those because of the scan lines on your phone. And if it was one of those bands, it would go all the way down the picture. It starts at the cone of the pyramid and goes up. It doesn't go all the way down the picture. And so I went, right. I know what that is. Have you seen that photo?
Well, I don't know about that photo, but again, this is the same description, again, with my conversation with Jim Stone when I was trying to talk about that, basically the pulse that then goes through that, the aluminum to hit the earth and then heats the earth. In a way, it's the same principle as what you're talking about. In other words, the lightning comes down, hits the ground, and triggers the what you call the electrolytes in the calcium.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot more than that in the stone. I mean, you have silica.
I mean, granite, right?
Granite is it's mica, it's quartz, and it's
you're saying it activated it.
When you have a strong electromagnetic field in the presence of crystal, it causes the electrons to jump out of their shells in the atoms and oscillate in the crystal.
Okay, and that oscillation does what?
The oscillation compresses at the cone of the pyramid, the top of it, and that's where it quantum tunnels and goes faster than light. That's what's happened in the two experiments I mentioned, the one at Berkeley with Raymond Chow and the one with Li Jun Wang at the Princeton laboratory.
Okay.
I mean, And that one was on NBC News. It was everywhere. I was amazed that nobody.
Yeah, I'm really, seeing it on the internet, actually.
Yeah, Legion. Yeah, it's amazing. 300 times the speed of light. Now, that's fast enough to send a signal to the Pleiades in a very short amount of time. So the question is, you know, with my transmitter wands, because I'm using rubies in them and I'm using tourmaline in the core, which tourmaline is full of magnesium and lithium is super high energy electrolyte. It's actually the highest energy electrolyte. So I get this huge energy field, which you can see on the meters, and I'm having people who are having experiences with it are having mystical experiences. But the question now is this what the pyramids were used for? Were they used as activators when they were turned on with these wands, with these transmitting devices? Because you need an ionizing form of electricity to activate the oscillations, whether that is lightning, or which means you would have to wait for that moment to happen to take advantage of it, or fire, which is a very primitive way of causing the electrons to move around in the crystal. And fire works. It's not as good, but it works, and that may explain the fire pits that researchers found in the... There's a movie called the Pyramid Code on... it's like a series. And they argue the case for the electric pyramid in that miniseries, and they found fire pits underneath. And I thought, well, that would definitely cause ionization and cause electrons to start moving around in the stone, which is why they get hot from the friction of the moving electrons. But electricity works much better. And so, with the pyramids, not only as in the ratio of Orion's belt, because the Great Pyramid, the three complex pyramids, are, and Orion is, those stars are over 1,000 light years away, way further than the Pleiades. Would it take you there? Would the person in the King's Chamber or Queen's Chamber, would they have contact with their deities faster than light, or would it be a star and physically take you there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to create a portal, because the pyramid is an ascension device. So, time travel and ascension, I think, are very closely related. I think people don't think about it that way, but it has the potential for that, because if you can travel between dimensions, then you can also travel from one to the other and above. In other words, you might be able to travel through densities.
Yeah, because there are different layers of density. We're in a very dense realm, so it's hard to move very fast. So what we're talking about doing now is, you know, I'm selling these wands now, but we're talking about going to Egypt and bringing one in with permission, because apparently there's power in the King's Chamber, and turning them on and starting the and actually transmitting the Great Pyramid frequencies into the Great Pyramid.
Well, but you just might disappear. The question is whether or not. Yeah, I mean, really, I'm serious.
And that might be my destiny. I'll have to wait till my daughter and my wife are with me.
Yeah, but you could, in theory, time travel just right there. But
well, I think that's what they were used for. I think they were, because see, everything we make today, Carrie, in the realm of crystal oscillators and transistors is so small, like the 1.7 billion transistors in an Intel chip. You can't even see them. They're like the size of cells. Well, the pyramids were crystal oscillators on a massive scale, and nobody does that today. Nobody thought, well, what happens if you build a big crystal oscillator?
Okay, well, let me ask you this, though. You know, you talked about the people have always called it a light bulb that's in, I guess, Dendera. The thing about it that's kind of interesting, because it sort of supports what you're saying about it, is that it is so large. In perspective to the man that's standing there, I mean, it's huge.
It's huge. And I, you know, I can say this to you because you've had a lot of mystical experiences. I've met those 8-foot-tall humans. I've actually used transmitting technology and asked them, and they appeared in my house in the middle of the daytime as a hologram, but I saw them perfectly clearly while I was in my bedroom with my daughter, and they're 8 foot tall, and they're human.
Yeah, I've seen a couple myself.
Right. They're very tall. So look, the humans that you see in that Dendera photo, those aren't kids and adults.
Right.
You're looking at gods. And remember, the royal cubit was elbow to fingertips plus another hand length versus the cubit. You know, there's a lot of different cubits out there. Now, this is really interesting because this gets into the exact frequencies in the pyramid. In Peter Lemazurier's book, he gives out what he believes is the master frequency that the Great Pyramid represents. And it's not a number that people are very commonly used to today, like Fibonacci or anything like that. It's the 5151. In fact, the original slope angle of the Great Pyramid slope was 51 degrees, 50.51 feet, and so many inches. That was the slope angle. And Lemazurier found the 5151 in other places in the pyramid. And he called it the master number, the highest frequency number. Well, when I was determining the oscillation frequencies in different parts of the pyramid, when you come to the top of the Great Pyramid, we'll do that when we come
back.
We're going
to a break. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio. We'll be right back after this short break, so stay tuned. Welcome to Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio is not intimidated by those who get upset when we disagree with their view of the world, those who try to make us politically correct, those who want to shove their religious or political views down your throat. Our program hosts have an opinion, informed, intelligent, and strong, and we always welcome yours. We are just a phone call away. We're not here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. We are here to share a point of view and listen to yours. We don't tell you what to say, how to think, what to do. We respect our listeners, even when we offend them. It's a tough world. It's always changing, and here we discuss all of that openly, honestly, and fearlessly, because we believe in the right to think and speak freely, so intelligent listeners can discuss, debate, and decide for themselves. Unlike many other stations, we believe in freedom of speech, even when we don't agree with what is being said. Our ethics are real and not contained in a box. We do not sing Mary Had a Little Lamb with fingers jammed in our ears. You don't need to expect us. We are already here. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
From 1 to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Together, we'll research the mysteries surrounding the past, the realities of the present, and how we can change our future. Right now is the most amazing time to be alive. Stranger Advice is about learning to live and living to learn more. Be sure to like us on Facebook, and you'll be entered to win a number of our giveaways. Let's go out of the realistic and into the mystic.
So be sure to join us for Stranger Advice with John Zaskoda, Fridays, noon Eastern, right here on freedomslips.com, Revolution Radio. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Hello, folks. This is Nighthawk, station owner at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Do you think you have what it takes to be a talk radio host? Well, there's no better time to find out than now. Revolution Radio is always looking for hosts that have new ideas and interesting takes on the world around them. If you would like to try your hand at being a Revolution Radio host, drop an email to me, Nighthawk, from the contact link on the main page of freedomslips.com. We are also the only internet talk radio station that I personally know of that now pays a portion of sponsorship proceeds to its hosts. But remember, it's not really about the income, it's about the reality of your world. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. Revolution. Revolution Radio.
You don't see it, do you? How close we are to absolute chaos. The sick ones are sitting on their fat asses, eating and drinking themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do the nasty work. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. Not me. Get it done.
Revolution Radio. Where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com. You're listening to Revolution Radio here at freedomslips.com and coming at you next. This is Carrie Cassidy with Whistleblower Radio, Project Camelot. So without much further ado, here's Carrie Cassidy. Take it away, Carrie.
Stretched out and purring, waiting for more. Strange shade of stone.
Okay, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio.
Where the darkness has passed and the magic yet grows.
Okay, David Cereda is here with us on the radio, and we are talking about time travel, crystals, ionization, and the Great Pyramid, and so on and so forth. David, are you still there?
Yeah, we were just about to reveal the frequency of the top of the pyramid. And this is very exciting because this has never been done before. Nobody has determined the pyramid as a crystal oscillator and figured out not its resonant frequency, but its crystal oscillating frequency. And when you take from Lemaitre's book, The Great Pyramid Decoded, the length of one of the square sides of the top of the pyramid, and it doesn't have its capstone, the base of the top of the pyramid is actually 572.80 primitive inches. 572.2 primitive inches. And a primitive inches was probably the real unit of measure that the Egyptians used, not the cubit. The cubit came out at a later date.
Yeah, let me address that. Do you know who Ben Peach is?
No.
Okay, Ben, and his last name is P-I-E-T-S-C-H, I believe, E. You can look him up on the internet. I believe I'm spelling his name right. He's written a couple books on the pyramid, and he's all about the measurements. He's maybe 80 years old or more. I've met him. One of our whistleblowers, Henry Deacon, insisted we meet him and said that he has one of the major, what he called, pieces of the puzzle. And Camelot is all about gathering pieces of the puzzle to create what is called the big picture. And Ben Peach, apparently, he's very into the measurements of the pyramid, and he does relate to it as an inch, not as a metric or other kind of measurement.
Yeah, the primitive inch is 1.00106 of what our inches are. So they're almost identical. But what's interesting about frequency is it doesn't matter whether it's metric or standard or whatever method. You always get the same number. There's different counting systems that are more accurate, but you get pretty much the same frequency, because frequency is universal. Like the number of times if you draw a circle at a certain speed, I can measure that in inches or in centimeters or millimeters. It's the number of times it's traveling around per second is always going to be the same. You just measure it differently. So the frequency is actually quite universal. But I believe the primitive inch, or it's pretty much the same as our inch, was the original Egyptian measurement. And so it's 572.2 primitive inches. And all you do is multiply that by 4. And if you see it as a square wave, which in electronics are square waves and circular waves and sawtooth waves, there's all kinds of waveforms. But as a square waveform, all you do is divide it into the speed of light, which I measured in primitive inches because I wanted to do this right down to the Egyptian standard. And the frequency you get is unbelievable. It's 5151314. So it's the same number in a different expression. You see, the slope on the pyramid was 51 degrees, 51 feet, 143 inches. The frequency of the capstone base is the 5151. And what's even more astounding, and this is where it gets really, really amazing, is the Ark of the Covenant. And I just found this out like 2 weeks ago. The Ark of the Covenant was 2.5 Egyptian, probably Egyptian royal cubits long. That's the measurement in the Bible. If you convert that to primitive inches, and Le Mesurier's book, the most common measurement inside the Great Pyramid is the 41.21 primitive inches, which is two royal cubits is the 4121. So all you do is cut that in half to get your primitive inches, and you multiply your 2.5 royal cubits length of the Ark of the Covenant, converted to primitive inches, and it's 51.51 primitive inches long. The same number. The frequency is the capstone of the Great Pyramid, and the same number is its slope, which is the same number of... You see, there's actually way more frequencies. Each side of the Great Pyramid is a slightly different length, so you get slight differential frequency. You get a lot of different waves overlapping on top of each other. So what you're seeing on my YouTube video at Spaceland 99, I'm transmitting in that video 48 Great Pyramid frequencies, but now I'm up to 180 that I've actually calculated. So you're seeing mathematical proof that the Ark of the Covenant probably belonged inside of the Great Pyramid. And it probably was an electronic capacitor, which is what, you know, Canadian scientist John Hutchison tested on one of these history channels. He built an Ark of the Covenant, and sure enough, it holds huge spikes of electricity, which is what capacitors do.
Oh, interesting.
And it has the 5151 in the original Egyptian measurement in Egyptian inches. Unbelievable. And its width in primitive inches is 30.90. Like, how beautiful, how perfect is that? 30.90, 30 goes into 90 three times. I mean, it's like this is, when you look at things in their original intended measurement, you see the code. And so what's causing the magnets to move on the plates in my video is the codes in the Great Pyramid. And the golden numbers do that also, but not as beautifully, not well. And the golden numbers are also in the pyramid.
But just curious whether or not you say the magnets are moving on the plate. Mm-hmm. What could that also be the way they move the stones?
Exactly. You're getting really close because I've done some further testing. I'm only putting 35 watts in there. And the one of the things that happens is, you know, like, go to the Coral Castle. Now, you see the guy had the magnet wheel, the wheel with all the magnets stacked on it, and he, when you hold an EMF meter, an electromagnetic field meter, next to a stationary magnet, and you don't get a reading, even though it's a strong magnet, as soon as the magnet is moving, the field gets huge. And the key is to get to spin magnets and then induce frequencies, I believe, to cause the right frequencies to cause the levitation of the stones. That's why the Coral Castle scientists use the wheel, the magnet wheel. That's my theory. So I'm now starting to put some more energy in these things, and people, you know, if they're in, you know, before we go into something else, if they want, if they're interested in one, just write davidsarita@hotmail.com and you can get more information about them, or lightstreamtechnologies.com, you can get more information there. So that work on ionizing crystal and putting specific harmonic sets, again, are different than frequencies. A frequency is a standalone number. The Great Pyramid has hundreds of frequencies built into it. Very sophisticated.
Before you go off this subject, though, I want to say that there's mm-hmm. also a key tie-in here with the Nazi Bell.
Right.
Okay, and they had these drums that were going counter-rotating, creating, right, setting up, some kind of magnetic field resonance there, and actually maybe made popular by the Jodie Foster movie Contact, if you mm-hmm. recall. And so again, still relating to setting up a field and creating a way to for time travel to happen.
Yeah, when I was a little kid and the Palladian showed me the inside of the craft, there were counter-rotating lights and magnetic fields. And what those do, I've been talking about those for years, the counter-rotating fields have to be slightly different frequencies, and so they don't slam into each other. They have to just miss each other, the rotating field, so they create up a differential between them.
Okay, and so this is again pointing to the differential thing that you talked about earlier, and yeah. I'm wondering whether, in a sense, what you're really talking about is sort of a synthesis that's happening, okay? Mm-hmm. So that you have two opposite forces, like a thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. The differential area of the equation would be, say, equal to the same thing as a synthesis, where two things come together simultaneously and create some kind of... is it your position? Because what you seem to be doing is, you said you're accessing that to sort of raise the vibration around your house and so on. But you see, there's also a tie-in there with the notion of ascension and a converging timelines, mm-hmm. to where two timelines converging, overlapping, could cause the same kind of differential concept. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Oh, yeah. See, think of equilibriums. Think of, this is an easier way to see it, because dimensions are equilibriums between two counter-rotating forces. A south magnetic field wants to send energy outwards, and a north magnetic field wants to pull energy inwards. A cell has a pressure pushing outwards on the cell and against the outside atmospheric pressure pushing in. The balance between the two is the cell membrane, or the equilibrium point. It's not actually equal. The cell is either expanding or contracting at any given moment. It's just like the atom. Though that fine balance, the precipice between clockwise and counterclockwise magnetic fields, are setting up a dimensional membrane. And, for example, the speed of light is in a vacuum, Einstein said, the speed of light is basically infinite. It the more pure the vacuum, the faster light travels. It's the atmosphere that light moves through that causes it to slow down. It depends on the material. It depends on the electric pressure of the atmosphere. In fact, when light goes through water, it goes a little bit slower than when it goes through air mass. When light goes through space, it goes through what we believe is about 300 kilometers per second. So we say, what is our dimension where we view time at this quantity or quanta as 186,282 miles per second? Well, that is only one differential expression of the leftover between the pressure of the infinite light speed, which is instantaneous, which isn't really light speed because it's instant, over different levels of or strata of pressure equilibriums to represent different dimensions. So when you set up vibrations, counter rotational vibrations, if their harmonics are correct, you can actually leave this differential vibration and go into another one. You might go into one that's heavier, where things are even slower, or you might go to one where there's less pressure and
well, it sounds that you might actually go in a sense vertically. So mm-hmm. that if two differentials come together, then you could go vertical, which means you can go up or down. But it's just a thought. It's like at an intersection that makes that possible. What I want to do is I've got a lot of people that are asking questions here, David, and I want to be able to ask you those questions because
sure.
we only have about, 40 minutes or less on the show. And so I would like to people are also saying that there seems to be some sound anomalies happening during the show. So I guess that we're probably being slightly interfered with here during this conversation simply because it's getting too interesting for certain parties out there. Would you mind if I gave you some of these questions that people are asking?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, and do you feel that you covered at least some of the subjects that we've been sort of trying to go down? Do you feel that you
well, yeah, the last thing I really wanted to say, in our emails to each other is comparing the solar system and the planets to subatomic particles and how energy, when it transfers to particles and planets, the particles change. They transform, and there are energy waves in our galaxy that are coming that are going to transform everything here. The particle, the planet, the DNA, everything is trying to change. Something very, very disturbing and interesting about the chemtrailing and the idea of creating a giant aluminum paramagnetic antenna that the military can broadcast frequencies into. There, in Claude Swanson's book, The Synchronized Universe, Robert Monroe, the out-of-body master, they did an experiment where they put a cage around his sleeping area, and they put some electricity in the cage through the wires. And at a particular voltage or frequency, he was unable to get out of body. He got trapped in the wires. And this is a very disturbing thought that with all the chemtrailing, the military might know that there are energies coming into our solar system that are trying to transform all of us. And this is a huge concerted effort to bombard the ionosphere and the atmosphere around our cities with very disturbing frequencies so that a lot of us don't get the shift. And it sounds like the most horrible, horrible nightmare to think that you can't get out of your body with when certain frequencies are, when you're using the aluminum in the atmosphere as a antenna to broadcast those frequencies in. But in my own experience, out of body, that if you can access your causal body, not your astral body, not your dreaming body. I mean, I've seen hundreds and hundreds of ghosts with my eyes open in my life, and I've seen the difference between the causal body and the astral body is night and day. I had an experience where some greys had me strapped to a table, and this is before the movie Matrix came out, and they were going to erase my memory. They had this syringe coming into my eye, And I immediately flipped out of my astral body, which they had trapped me on the table with, and I went into this super light body, the causal body. And my causal body was so powerful, it started doing kung fu at an alarming speed, like, I mean, faster than, and this is before the Matrix came out, which was really funny. And they just fled in terror. They just left. They could not handle the vibration. So the key is to activate your DNA through meditation and other means so that you get the causal body activated so that you can't be trapped.
Exactly. A very, very important point. Basically creating, making sure that you outfit your light body and get yourself, sort of equipped to handle what's going on here. It also allows you to handle the energy that's coming in and to bypass. I'm thinking that maybe, and I'm not a scientific, person all that much, but I have heard the term Faraday cage, and I'm wondering if this, if that's what's being created, is a sort of Faraday cage.
They're caging us in. You know, I found on Navy's website, they have 150 gigawatt transmitters, microwave transmitters right now. Now, you're talking about 3 gigs and 4 gigs with your iPad, you know, the 4 gig network. And the 4G network is pretty powerful. I mean, it's, you know, we have actually created these laptop shields at wavetech.us where you can actually put your laptop down and you can hold an EMF meter on the other side, and we're truly blocking the 4G signal, which is really hard. The 4G signal was not easy to block. Now, think that the military now has 150 gigawatt transmitters to transmit frequencies into this aluminum dusty antenna that they're spraying on it. It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
I do want to say, though, that, you know, it also has to do with the kinds of beings that they're allowing to come into this dimension and the ones they're trying to block from coming in. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's just energies. It's also the beings that are visiting.
No, you're absolutely, actually, we sent out a question on our transmitters, and that's the answer they gave us back. They're trying to block them from being able to communicate with a lot of us.
Right.
They're creating a Faraday cage around us so that nothing can get in and out.
Exactly. Yeah, very, very interesting. Okay, so at this moment, what I want to do is ask you a couple questions that are happening, and I just want to announce that I guess something happened to one of the servers. People were complaining that there was some sound issues or whatever. I guess they're dealing with that. Hold on one second here.
Suddenly hearing like a, sounds like a storm.
Yeah, interesting, huh? I don't know what that is. I didn't do anything different. Now it's diminishing. Okay.
Now it's diminishing, yeah.
Somebody tried to DDoS one of the servers. I've got it taken care of and everything's back up and running now.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, wild and crazy. Okay, so back to the questions, David. Someone wants me to ask you, you were talking about some very tall beings that were communicating with you, and someone would like me to ask you what, if anything, they told you.
Well, I mean, we were experimenting with I built an experimental faster-than-light transmitter to talk to the Pleiades star system. And I did all the math on the codes for that star system and built a harmonic transmitter, not a frequency-based transmitter, and we used some living material. There's a lot of evidence that plants, through Fritz Albert Popp's work in Germany, transmit biophotons faster than light with each other. So, in fact, you can Google this on the Internet, that there are companies that are making transistors that interface with living material. And the living material component, even though it can send a faster-than-light signal, if you don't know the harmonic codes of where you're sending the signal, it won't really get there. And when we first did this, we didn't know what would happen. We did it 2 birthdays ago for me, August 21st, 2 years ago. And we did it last summer as well on my birthday. And unbelievable things happened. I mean, it's a whole story. I actually have a CD
of that whole experience on my website through lightstreamtechnologies.com. If people just ask for the Palladian CD, because it's I don't really want to do it injustice and say, you know, in few words. But that being one of the transmissions, we asked them to appear to us in a manner that would be that wouldn't compromise their security and safety, and if that meant a hologram. And this afternoon, particular afternoon, about 2 weeks after we sent the question out, and I had not seen a ghost for over a year when this had happened. In fact, my daughter, before she was born, Alira, I saw her shining with light beside her bed, and when everybody said we were going to have a boy, and there's this little girl floating beside the bed, she's the last ghost I saw. And in fact, I still haven't seen one since. So it's all kind of stopped, you know, that thing that was happening with me for a while. And so when I saw this being in the room, it wasn't my normal background as I normally see ghosts. It was in the day, and I normally see ghosts at night, spirit beings and masters, etc. This was in the middle of the day, and it was just stunning. They were about 8 foot tall.
Okay. I hear you. Okay. Yeah, I had two experiences with the tall beings. What do they call this? The highest chamber of the pyramid. It's there's a room up there.
The king's chamber, you're talking.
I guess the king's chamber. Above the king's chamber, there's a.
Yeah, right.
I forget what it's called. Anyway, it's. I saw Tho. Or a being wearing a Tho outfit kind of thing, with tablets in hand.
Wow. Were you in there?
No, I just, it was a vision that I saw. I guess it was during the night, you know, I was sort of asleeping, but I just saw it, you know.
And, you were in the half in, half out state?
I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just, because I do remember it, and the other one was, it was very interesting. You'll probably be slightly interested in this because at the time I did move to Sedona for about 6 months. And right before I moved to Sedona, this was a few years ago, I was really trying to decide whether or not I should go there. And one night I went to sleep and I had this dream that was more like an experience, obviously. And I was in this place with red sands and a river, and I was on kind of like one side of the river, and a very tall being was on the other side, and then I guess they gestured that I should come across, and they stood beside me, and they let me know that they were protecting me. It was very interesting.
Wow.
So, that was very powerful, that dream. But I want to move on to some questions here for you. Let's see, your link to your rubies, I guess the things that you created with using rubies, right? Necklaces or?
Well, we have our necklaces and pendants that are harmonically treated, but the transmitter wand, all that is at lightstreamtechnologies.com.
Okay, lightstream.technologies.com. There's a very interesting question here that I like very much. A person's asking, have you ever talked to David Adair?
Yes, you know, this is kind of disturbing, but I worked on the Helium 3 Fusion project, and David Adair wanted to know all about it. We were on the phone together, and he had no knowledge of Helium 3 Fusion and the mining operations on the dark side of the moon by other beings or possibly even our military. And all of a sudden, he was talking about Helium 3 in the following years, and I was like,
"Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio."
He didn't know anything about it before I told him everything about it. And maybe he did some of his own research on it. So that's maybe why the person is asking the question.
Okay, that's interesting.
There's not very many physicists who are working on Helium 3. The Japanese got some money for it for a while.
You are listening to Revolution Radio at FreedomSlips.com. Join us here Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for Live Market Action Watch with none other than the Crow. All the overnight market movements and current outlook for today. What is hot in news that affects the market, along with Crow's own personal opinion based on the numbers. We X-ray the market like no one else on radio or TV.
I don't know anybody else is doing it, so I don't know how David Adair.
For the first 2 hours, beginning 30 minutes before the open, and continuing for another hour and a half, that's live market action. Watch with the Crow. That's 9 a.m.
Interesting. Well, my understanding is David Adair has also gone sort of off the scene. He's just disappeared. Kind of like.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We had a long conversation many years ago, and we never met.
Okay.
A lot of researchers don't end up meeting each other, even at conferences. It's kind of strange.
It is. Okay, so there's another very interesting question here, which I want to make sure to ask you. Okay, there was a large anomaly near the sun a few days ago. Did you happen to hear about it, and do you know anything about it?
Oh, yeah, I got involved in that a little bit. The disk that was attached, it had a long tentacle, and it was black, a black disk that was showing up on the NASA SDO account. And I verified it definitely was there. It was explained away as kind of a plasma ball that ejected off of the sun. But it looked like it was separate from the sun, and it was enormous, enormous in size. I mean, many times the size of Jupiter. And it had a long black, not, you know, luminous plasma. It was very dark, and which is very strange. And it was not emitting light. It was in the dark. I don't understand what it was, but there are many things in the solar system when you start getting into cameras with different sensitivity to different spectroscopes that show up that really amaze us. There may be living plasma.
Okay, yes. We're going to a break. We'll be right back, and then we'll take some calls as well.
Listening to Revolution Radio. We'll be right back after this short break, so stay tuned.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Join us here Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for Live Market Action Watch with none other than the Crow. All the overnight market movements and current outlook for today, what is hot in news that affects the market, along with Crow's own personal opinion based on the numbers. We x-ray the market like no one else on radio or TV. We go where others fear to tread. For the first 2 hours, beginning 30 minutes before the open and continuing for another hour and a half, that's live market action. Watch with the Crow. That's 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday through Friday.
Money is a gas. Grab that cash with both hands and make a stash.
This is what I am. I'm the host of the Urban Revolution Show here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. My beautiful co-host is Miss Debbie. Urban Revolution is on Tuesdays from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Urban Revolution, we cover issues and topics that are near and dear to the urban communities. We drop the walls and give you grassroots opinions on a given subject without worrying about political correctness. We welcome your calls and hope that you be as free and sincere when you do call in. Join me, what I am, and my co-host, Miss Debbie, on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Okay, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and we are talking to David Cereda. We're about to take some calls, and this is going to be an interesting juggling act. So I guess we're going to rely on, I don't even know his name, but he's sort of helping produce the show behind the scenes here, and he tells me he's dealing with, you know, hackers and all kinds of craziness going on, which kind of, oh, Nighthawk, wow. I got the real guy there. So thank you so much. And we've got a person on the line. Caller, go ahead. Okay, do we have a caller on the line?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to go ahead?
All right. Ronnie, you're on the line.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Hi, Carrie and David.
We're cool. Calling from Australia.
Awesome.
Wow.
And I hear, Carrie, you coming down for a visit later in the year?
Yeah, we're working on it. We're absolutely working on it.
Looking forward to that, honey. Hey, enjoying your show, guys. Well done.
Thank you so much.
And David, I would like to ask you in the multidimensional situation that you've been speaking about, what the 369 means to us.
The 369, I don't really know. See, I don't think single frequencies, they have a power. I'm not going to say they don't have a power. I've even looked at the solfeggio numbers and tonally compared them to the ascension numbers on a single side of the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is incredibly complex. It's not easy to figure out.
I'm not speaking about a frequency here. I'm speaking about the 369 point triangle. But you know, we can speak on frequency as the 432. But what I was trying to bring out is the 369 triangle 3-point destination.
No, I got to say I'm not aware of that, so I shouldn't comment on that.
Okay.
And I might suggest that maybe you look a little bit further than the solfeggio frequencies, because I believe they've been screwed with severely as well.
No, that's what I was going to say. I'm not very impressed with them. I mean, the pyramid ascension tones, just tonally, are so beautiful compared to the solfeggio. And so I'm not that impressed with them, actually.
Okay, thank you very much, Ronnie and team there. I hope to see you when I come to Australia. I guess we'll try to take another call. I believe we got a lot of people backed up, and I've got several questions in the queue here. Not much time to go. Is that all right with you?
Yes.
Okay, so we should have another caller, sort of queuing up here in the background. Go right ahead, Nighthawk, if you want to pull somebody else up. Meanwhile, I also do have more questions here, as I said, in the queue.
Yeah, let's go ahead and give out the number. It's 347-688-2902, and since our time is short, there'll be a 2-minute limit, so one question per caller, please. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. It looks like, wow. Okay, someone is asking, is your wand something that we could make ourselves using rubies and tourmaline? If so, how?
No, it's my invention, and it's not just the wand, it's the exact harmonics that transmit through it that I've also invented and did all the math on. So they're very hard to make, and if you I'm not going to give out how you make them. But if you tried to make one yourself, it would be extremely difficult to get a single piece of wire and all of the rubies and the tourmaline, and there's other gems in there too, but to do that. But you can also become a distributor and get them wholesale, so they're less money. I mean, they're about the same price as the crystal biomats. You know, the amethyst biomats are $1,700. These are $1,700. But they wholesale at $1,100, so you can talk to me about that.
Okay, wow, very expensive.
Yeah, rubies are expensive, and so are, I actually hire jewelers to make them and to do the electronics that I designed, and then there's the you know, all the different CDs, and there's all the amplifier and all of that too. So.
Okay, well, let me suggest that it might be nice to make it a little more affordable, or at least another affordable version.
Well, the only way I can make them more affordable is to make them in China, and I really like to employ Americans to do stuff. You know, they would be cheaperly made if I had them made there too, and that's what Apple does. That's what everybody does. They go to China to get electronics made, and if you want to make this yourself, the materials alone, just the materials, are about $700.
Okay. I've got someone asking what you think about the Earth sounds. Do you think there's any kind of link up between the energies coming in at this time and the sounds that people are hearing?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, the sounds, my wife hears them at night in association with out-of-body experiences on the ships. I think some of the sounds are the invisible dimension ships, and I think some of the sounds have to do with the tectonic activity and the grinding of the Earth's crust and plates, because of the magnetic poles are shifting. The North Magnetic Pole is migrating faster than we would expect right now. In fact, I talked to Larry Newitt, the scientist who collects the data for NASA in the Northwest Territories of Canada. I talked to him personally online, and because I said, you know, there's no new data from several years now, and even years ago the drift rate had accelerated, and he said it's still accelerating. So when a magnetic field...
Okay, I'm sorry, and I want you to finish your thought there, but I did send you some material on that, and I wonder if you had a chance to look at it.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Oh.
A magnet will always respond to a magnetic field, just like in my wand. You see, the magnetic field is moving, so therefore the magnet moves. Now, the Earth is a magnet. Its Gauss strength at the core is way stronger than NASA had previously estimated. They've done new tests to find out it's not an ultra-weak magnet. It's considered a weak magnet, but it's nevertheless a magnet. And therefore, if the Earth's magnetic field moves and migrates, eventually the physical magnet has to move. Now, the Earth only has to move a single degree, which is about 70-something miles per degree on the periphery of the planet. If we even moved 1 degree of physical pole shifting, it would be devastating to the surface activity on the planet. So all those sounds, the grinding, and you're seeing earthquakes and boom noises. You're seeing earthquakes in places that don't normally have them. You're hearing people are waking up in the middle of the night and hearing strange, like, ripping sounds and, you know, almost screaming sounds.
Yeah, I have to say it sounds like that to me. It really does.
I think we're starting to see the beginning of a physical movement of the magnet that the Earth actually is.
Well, my understanding is there will be a pole shift on the Sun before there is a pole shift on the Earth. Have you heard that?
Well, the Sun is the magnetic field transmitter in the case of the solar system. And, yes, something has to shift there first before you see real serious physical movement here.
Yeah, I wonder what the downtime is between the one and the other.
Oh, it's the magnetic field lines are instant.
Wow.
You know, when you get a coronal mass ejecta from the Sun, which is charged particles, it takes 3 days to get here. So you get two effects. First, you get the instant magnetic effect, and then you get the charged particles. So it depends what kind of activity it is that could cause it. But we're already seeing the magnetic field line on the Earth has already moved so much. I'm actually surprised the physical Earth hasn't really moved that much. I mean, there was the early sunrise reported 2 years ago.
Iceland? Yeah.
Yeah. And there were some Inuit Indians in northern Canada who were saying they know where the sun sets every winter. At this time of the year, it sets on that mountain, and they said it's not setting there anymore. So something is shifted, and different parts of the Earth, like imagine one part of the Earth's crust shifts and another one doesn't. So a certain person on the planet or geography location has already moved, because it's all very liquid-like. It's not like it all moves in unison. You know, little pieces can move, you know, slightly separately from each other because they're like little islands. So one person can see the sunrise setting in a different place, and another one says, oh, no, it's still setting in the same place.
Okay. We've got a few other questions here. Person asking, do you think we resonate at a particular harmony with Logos with the Earth and other energies for the coming energy?
Well, yeah. I mean, Logos is God. I mean, in John 1, in the beginning, the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. And in Greek, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are Greek manuscripts. It means perfect harmonic ratio. And ratios are all differential-based numbers. And it, again, so it's not a frequency. It's a whole set of harmonics. And it's...
Well, this is where resonance, though. I think the person actually used the word resonate, and I think that that's a good choice of word.
Yeah, don't resonant you? Is that's a perfect question. That's what I'm pointing out. I highly agree with resonance as opposed to frequency. So you can feel it shifting. My concern is it depends on where you live on the planet. I don't know if they're experiencing chemtrails in Australia, for example. I don't know if all the militaries of the world are beaming harmful frequencies and creating webs above their cities. Probably not. I mean, it would be a lot of aluminum you would have to spray to fill the whole planet. So there are safe places to go where that isn't happening, and you're more likely to receive the natural vibrations. But eventually, they can't stop it. I mean, the vibrations that are coming, that are, you know, already at Purdue University, they're seeing that the sun is causing the decay rates of certain nuclear particles to change from their normal time of decay, which means that the energy is already here. And our DNA is already receiving a new imprint.
Okay, that's interesting. Are you aware of the work of Paul LaViolette?
Paul LaViolette, I mean, I know his name, but, you know, this is the funny thing is when, so you have a better job than I do. I get myopic. I spent my whole year decoding the frequencies of the Great Pyramid when 2 years ago I had this theory that it was a crystal oscillator. So I don't get to look at very much that other people are doing, and some of the stuff people are doing is so fantastic, and I get to see a little bit of it. But
well, the reason I'm asking is because, you know, I've been trying to encourage him to sort of revise, I guess, his theory, because he has this theory that there is energies coming in. There's what he calls an energetic superwave. And my information, even from Black Projects, is that it is not only did they go out flying interstellarly and were able to check and saw that it was on its way, but at this point it is here, as you say. And there is a lot of, you know, enough anomalous events and enough changes even in our solar system to indicate that it's very likely that I think it's here. And however, he at this time does not seem to be willing to sort of revise it and say that it hasn't happened yet, so to speak. So it is very interesting when you're talking about these energetics that are incoming, which seem, you know, like you cannot ignore that fact, and yet where they're coming from and what it is made of. There's also this idea of what's been called the fluffy cloud. Are you familiar with that theory?
No.
Okay, there's a cloud mass.
It's so funny because I'm normally aware, but I got to admit when I don't know.
No, it's just another Black Project scientist who came forward at a certain point from Boeing that another person brought forward the information, and this guy went into hiding, but he delivered the information to this guy. About what was, it's called an interstellar fluffy cloud, and it seems to be, I don't know, it's sort of like an electromagnetic sort of cloud mass, but it's not cloud, it's made of something else completely.
Well, exactly. You know, when you have
moving into this cloud.
Yeah, when you can man make or human make a cloud of particles of aluminum and chemicals and silica and water, you basically have a giant super, you know, transistor antenna, and you can really mess with people, you know, terribly if you're beaming from these, you know, 150 gigawatt transmitters into these clouds. It can really mess people up. They might be trying to mess the aliens up, because a lot of the aliens, you can see the shape of their ship. They morph They appear in the invisible spectra, which is where they are most of the time, around our cloud mass. The clouds kind of start to move around the shape of the craft.
Well, this is something out in space, though.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're out there, too. So we might be, you know, because you can beam a microwave weapon at the speed of light anywhere in the relative solar system in a very short amount of time. And that can be a form of weapon, you know, a weapon used
Absolutely.
Against them. And when you get into the subject of weapons, I have stuff, terrifying stuff, about the shuttle Columbia and the proof that it was shot down by either them or us. Nobody really knows, but we have the photographic evidence that it was shot down. There's definitely
Very interesting.
A war going on.
I have, yes, and I actually have a witness who also addressed that on one of my interviews. So thank you, David. That's really good information. I'd love to go down that road with you. I wish we had more time.
Yeah, when you get into the realm of the demigods, it was all, you know, Indra and Zeus. Whoever possessed the most powerful weapon was the ruler in that realm, in that domain. But when you get into the realm of the angelic and the causal light body realms, none of those weapons mean anything, because those beings, their powers, you know, my experience when I met Christ in person three times in the 1990s, and his power is not too powerful for this realm. You know, what we saw of him in the physical flesh was as if he put on a million pairs of sunglasses to block how much light is really in that being, so that we could even pretend that we were seeing him. Those beings just dwarf the gods and their weapons, and the demigods and their weapons. But in our realm, we're physical beings. We have demigods and goddesses above us who are warfaring-type beings, and the rulers of those classes have the most powerful weapons. And we're in the middle of it, you know. In the Buddhist cosmologies, you know, the demigods and goddess realms, even though their bodies, they're physically more beautiful than us, live thousands of years, long lifetimes, they avoid reincarnating in those realms. They want to be here because humans can eventually get true enlightenment and accelerate way beyond the demigod realms. But we physically have to deal with them. They come into our space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, saying that you met Jesus Christ is a very loaded statement. That would take probably at least half a show to go into. So I guess I'm not going to challenge you on that right this second here, but let me just draw attention to the fact that I'm completely aware that there's more to be said there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I've got somebody else asking, do you have a therapy for the Fukushima radiation?
Well, for Fukushima radiation, you, one, need to raise your body voltage so that you can, when your cells are in a higher voltage state, they can defend themselves better, depending on what radionuclear particles you're talking about ingesting in your body that may have migrated, and many of them have. In fact, in Berkeley, California, they found plutonium-238. In the air, and that is the most deadly of all particles. There's nothing worse than plutonium-238. It is one millionth of a gram will kill you. So you have to raise your body voltage. You have to get the particles out of you if some of them have gotten in you, like strontium or even there's so many radionuclear particles that they're not even mentioning in the media. You know, you have to do a lot of heavy metal cleansing. You've got to raise your body voltage, which my pendants can prove to do, the ones at lightstreamtechnologies.com. And then you've got to take silica, you've got to take germanium, you've got to increase your germanium intake, which is your crystal content. We don't have garlic contains germanium, and so does the reishi mushroom. You have to get your crystal content much higher so your body can handle it. Like, there's a story from when we dropped the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the poor Japanese who ate the brown rice didn't get cancer as much as the richer people who ate the white rice. And turns out brown rice is high in magnesium, which is an electrolyte. It's the second highest electrolyte. So when you increase your electricity levels in your body, your volts per cell go up, and your cell wall can defend the DNA in the center of the cell better from the radiation.
Okay, well, along those lines, actually, I think that they are, in essence, terraforming the Earth at this time to create a different atmosphere. And I do believe that this is part of what is it has to do with sort of a population elimination or a reduction program, but it also has to do with kind of a philosophy that only the strong will survive. The ones that are able to sort of morph their bodies to be able to handle the sort of changing atmosphere that we're having to deal with here it's an interesting dynamic going on, because you can rise above it if you raise your vibration and your DNA, activate certain parts of the DNA, but there's other things going on where as you say, you can use certain additions to your diet and so on.
Well, yeah, it's not just the chemicals, like, you know, putting the germanium in your body and the magnesium. You have to activate it, and that's where, you know, either meditation or things like the transmitter wand, or, you know, there are other technologies out there that you can physically, the physical part of your body, you can raise the frequency with. There's many ways to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of proof. Like for example, if you ingest germanium and silica, which are, silica is just quartz. It's the same thing quartz is. It's tetrahedron. To get it to give off ions, you have to ionize it. And the body is electric, but you to really get it activated, it needs some form of ionization.
Okay, let's see. We're running up against the end of the show, but I want to see if I can get any kind of last minute. Do you feel that the pyramids around the Earth resonate to create a grid structure like zona pellicula egg membrane?
Oh, I believe without the pyramids we would be in great trouble. I think their place. Have you seen Patrice Pouillard's new film on the pyramids?
No, I don't think so.
It is phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's so stunning in the end. I mean, just Google Patrice Pouillard, Pouyard.
Okay.
I forget the name of the movie. And get yourself a copy of it or see it wherever you can. It is phenomenal. There's a mathematician. He doesn't show his face or his name. And he shows you where the speed of light is coded in the pyramid's math. And all you do is take a compass in the center of the pyramid's dimensions and draw a circle to your square faces and another one to the corners, and you get two different size circles. And in metric, if you subtract a small one from the big one, you're left with the number of the speed of light. And that's what, you know, really proved to me that it was a crystal oscillator, because you need the speed of light to measure your dimensions into to get your frequencies. And that film shows you where all the pyramids are placed all over the world. It's on this like 150-mile thick line straight across all the way around the planet. And the distances between each of them are all perfectly harmonic. I mean, they were all placed here in every one of them. They all have a function to balance the forces.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. And I think that there's more and more evidence to that effect. I think Hugh Newman is investigating that as well as a lot of other people that he has getting involved in some of the things he's doing at Megalithmania, just to give him a small plug there. Let's see. It looks like we need to end the show. Do you want to give some, I guess the talk has been going crazy. I'm sorry we didn't get to everything. We certainly should have you back, David. It's been a pleasure. Let me see. Can you give out your websites and any other pertinent information, even where you're, let's see, where you are going to be speaking in the near future?
Well, my websites are thelightstreamtechnologies.com is where my harmonically treated crystal jewelry and the wands are. And we even have pendants that are only $50 for different people's abilities, all the way up to several hundred dollars. And then my films are at voiceentertainment.net. And my computer laptop shields with my partner Mark are at wavetech.us. That's wavetech.us. If you want to get real protection against your laptop and and using your laptop on your, you know, near your reproductive organs is very dangerous, so you really want to protect that area of the body. So that's where that is. I just spoke at the UFO Congress about my pyramid theory, which was very well received.